Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand, Kelly Jean Kelly, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
In the kitchen of the Drug Rehabilitation Center in Lamu, Kenya, Musa Mohammed is stirring a pan full of chicken and herbs. Musa is a 43-year-old drug user. He is one of 18 addicts at the center, which is run by the Kenya Red Cross. He started using heroin 14 years ago after his friends recommended it to him. Then I kept on trying, and after a couple of days, I wanted to stop, and I was addicted already, so I wasn't able to stop, he said. Kenya's National Authority for the Campaign Against Alcohol and Drug Abuse says there are 40,000 heroin users across the coastal area of Kenya. Many live in Lamu, a town with a large number of drug dens. Red Cross volunteer Noreen Mohammed often visits the drug dens where she sees the desperation of many addicts. 43-year-old Yusuf Yunus understands that desperation. He wants to stop using drugs. Now, I have two children of mine who will get in trouble, he said. I don't know what to do because I am high. I am not healthy for them, and I don't know how to get money. I cannot help my children when I am high. The rehabilitation center gives addicts medicine to lessen painful withdrawal symptoms. The center also requires that addicts attend group counseling. Christine Mosiori is the manager of the Lamu Center. She says high unemployment and easy availability of drugs are causing the drug problem. Unemployment makes it easy for someone to just get into the drugs, and also the availability of these drugs where they live, she said. The program run by the Red Cross takes 3 months and provides some job training. Then, reformed drug users go back to the streets. Musa says he won't go back using drugs. My first daughter is 14 years old now. I don't want to hurt my daughter and my family, he said. So I said enough is enough, and I don't think I'll go back. Despite the large size of the drug problem, Mosiori says she is pleased by what the Red Cross Center has done in just 6 months. Even those we have discharged, we have followed them up so far, and they are actually doing very well back home, Mosiori said. As the men kneel for Islamic prayers, they share the pain of trying to overcome addiction. They pray that one day soon they will regain control over themselves and their futures. I'm Susan Shand.
The 4th of July is Independence Day in the United States. On this holiday, Americans often remember their country's founders. the English colonists who separated from Britain. But in a new book, writer Kwame Alexander urges readers to remember all the people who built the country.
Is there one voice in America? No, there are many voices. And the idea is that we have to recognize, acknowledge, be proud of, pay tribute to all those voices.
His book is called The Undefeated. It is a love letter to America, to Black America, Alexander told VOA. Most pages include oil paintings by artist Kadir Nelson. The pictures show great athletes, activists, and artists, Muhammad Ali and Michael Jordan, Martin Luther King Jr., Billie Holiday, and Ella Fitzgerald. The pictures also show people whose names we do not know, a family, a soldier, and bodies crowded onto a slave ship.
But they represent a community, a culture, a people. They represent America. And that's what I was trying to say, that this is America. As Langston Hughes said, I too sing America.
Like Langston Hughes, Kwame Alexander is a poet. On a recent visit to VOA, Alexander talked about growing up in both the city and the country. His words create a picture of two very different places in the United States.
You walk out your door in Brooklyn, New York, and there's 100 other people, and you're on the street, and there's trash, and there's horns, and there's honking, and there's music, and there's somebody breakdancing over here, and there's energy. And you're in Chesapeake, Virginia, and there's a rooster when you walk outside your house.
He says both experiences helped make him who he is. One thing the two parts of his life had in common were books.
Books were everywhere in our house. And I think that gave me and my sisters this feeling that anything was possible, that the world was within our reach. We could travel anywhere without having left our home through the pages of a book.
As an adult, Alexander traveled not only through books, but in real life. He often traveled to Ghana.
And on one of my visits, I noticed that there were no books in the school. And there was certainly no library because there were no books. Again, being someone who is in the business of words and understands the power of literature to transform lives, I said, I want to build a library for these students.
So for several years, Alexander raised money and found books for a library. The building was nearly complete. But then Alexander realized something important.
It occurred to me that I had never asked anyone in the village what they wanted.
The elders in the village told him what they most needed. And in 2018, the project opened as the Barbara Alexander Memorial Library and Health Clinic. It combined both books and medicine, care for both the mind and the body.
I think that was probably a big part of my life's work. It's one thing to write books. I think it's important if you're going to write about something that's authentic, you sort of got to live an authentic life.
His book, The Undefeated, aims to connect readers not only to authentic lives, but to authentic American history. Some parts are difficult and painful. He uses the words uncertain, unspoken, untitled. Some parts are proud and victorious. After all, the title is The Undefeated. And some parts are simply human.
This is for you, and you, and you, and you. This is for us. Pretty much says it all right there, doesn't it?
I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
A Google-backed project to bring internet connectivity to rural areas around the world is set to launch its first service in Kenya. The project is led by Loon, which is owned by Google's parent company, Alphabet. Large balloons carry solar-powered equipment high in the sky to send high-speed internet signals to the ground. Loon officials told the Reuters news service that its balloons are expected to reach Kenya in the coming weeks. Loon began testing the system in 2011, but this is the company's first market test. The project involves Telkom Kenya, the country's third-largest telecommunications company. The service will sell 4G internet service to people living in a rural, mountainous area. Kenyan transportation officials said they expect to give final approval to the project this month. Loon aims to bring high-speed internet connectivity to places where populations are unserved or underserved. The sky-based system can deploy to areas where there are too few people to support the building of signal equipment on the ground. The balloons that lift the equipment are about 24 meters tall and 8 meters wide, Loon says in a description on its website. It is made of a plastic material that is built to last at least 100 days. The balloons are filled with gas that is lighter than air and rise up to 20 kilometers into the sky, a height twice as high as airplanes fly. This helps the balloons avoid weather problems and wildlife. Loon balloons move through the skies by wind currents that carry them up and down during the flight path. They are designed to link up with a team of balloons over areas lacking internet connectivity. Stations on the ground send signals from local internet service providers up to the balloons. These signals are then fed back to Earth in a similar way to how satellites work. People on the ground can then connect to the high-speed internet service. Loon says solar collectors power the equipment during the day and charge a battery to run the system at night. When the life of the balloon ends, a parachute self-deploys to guide it back down to the ground. The sky-based system already showed success in temporary service launches in Peru and Puerto Rico during natural disasters. Loon says its balloons were operational in 48 hours in May after a powerful earthquake struck a rural part of Peru. In the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico, Loon balloons were deployed after Hurricane Maria hit in 2017. In both cases, the equipment was provided for free to make up for internet signals that had been cut. Alistair Westgarth heads Loon. He says that in addition to Telkom Kenya, several other telecommunications companies are close to signing deals with the company. He did not provide details. Officials at several wireless carriers told Reuters they are still exploring the possibilities of working with Loon. Hervé Souquet is head of technology and information for Orange Middle East and Africa. He said Loon first needs to prove itself in Kenya. If the results are positive, we would then be potentially interested, he said in a statement. Kuwait-based carrier Zain Group said it too is watching the Kenyan trial closely before making a decision on Loon. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Soon after his presidency began, there was an attempt on his life. A gunman shot President Reagan in March 1981. Doctors removed the bullet. He rested, regained his strength, and returned to the White House in 12 days. The new president wanted to reduce the size of the federal government. He and other conservative Republicans wanted less government interference in the lives of Americans. President Reagan won congressional approval for his plan to reduce income tax rates. Many Americans welcomed the plan. Others were concerned about its effects on the national debt. They saw taxes go down while defense spending went up. To save money, the Reagan administration decided to cut spending for some social programs. This pleased conservatives. Liberals, however, said it limited poor people's chances for good housing, health care, and education. President Reagan also had to make decisions about using military force in other countries. In 1983, he sent Marines to Lebanon. They joined other peacekeeping troops to help stop fighting among competing groups. On October 23rd, a truck carrying explosives bombed Marine housing at Beirut International Airport.
There was nothing in its appearance to suggest it was any different than the trucks or cars that were normally seen on and around the airport. But this one was different. At the wheel was a young man on a suicide mission. The truck carried some 2,000 pounds of explosives. But there was no way our Marine guards could know this. Their first warning that something was wrong came when the truck crashed through a series of barriers. The guards opened fire, but it was too late. The truck smashed through the doors of the headquarters building in which our Marines were sleeping and instantly exploded.
241 Americans were killed. Two days later, Marines led an invasion of the Caribbean island nation of Grenada. Communist forces were rebelling against the government there. Cuban soldiers were guarding the streets. President Reagan said he feared for the safety of American students at a medical school in Grenada. He sent the Marines to get them out safely. The Marines quickly defeated the communist forces. Many Americans were pleased. Others were angry. They said Grenada was invaded only to make people forget about what happened in Lebanon. The next year, 1984, was a presidential election year. It looked like no one could stop President Reagan. His warm way with people had made him hugely popular. He gained support with the military victory in Grenada. And by the time the campaign started, inflation was under control. The Republican Party renominated Ronald Reagan for president and George Bush for vice president. There were several candidates for the Democratic Party's nomination. One was the first African American to seek the presidency, Jesse Jackson. He was a Protestant clergyman and a longtime human rights activist. The candidate who finally won the nomination was Walter Mondale. He had been a senator and had served as vice president under President Jimmy Carter. The vice presidential candidate was Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro. It was the first time a major party in the United States had nominated a woman for national office.
Tonight, the daughter of working Americans tells all Americans that the future is within our reach if we're willing to reach for it.
One issue in the election campaign was taxes. Political candidates often try to avoid talking about taxes with voters. But former Vice President Mondale did talk about the issue. He said taxes would have to be raised to pay for new government programs.
The American people will have to pay Mr. Reagan's bills. The budget will be squeezed. Taxes will go up. And anyone who says they won't is not telling the truth to the American people.
This was a serious political mistake. President Reagan gained even more support as a result. The two candidates agreed to debate on television. During one debate, President Reagan looked old and tired. He did not seem sure of his answers. Yet his popularity was not damaged. On Election Day, he won 59% of the popular vote. On Inauguration Day, the weather was bitterly cold in Washington. All inaugural activities, including the swearing-in ceremony, were held inside. President Reagan's first term began with an attempt on his life. 6 months after his second term began, he faced another threat. Doctors discovered and removed a large growth from his colon. The growth was cancerous. The president was 74 years old. Yet once again, he quickly regained his strength and returned to work. For years, the United States had accused Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi of supporting international terrorist groups. It said he provided them with weapons and a safe place for their headquarters. In January 1986, the United States announced economic actions against Libya. Then it began military training exercises near the Libyan coast. Libya said the Americans were violating its territory and fired missiles at them. The Americans fired back, sinking two ships. On April 5th, a bomb destroyed a dance club in West Berlin. An American soldier and another person were killed. The United States said Libya was responsible. President Reagan ordered a bombing raid on the Libyan cities of Tripoli and Benghazi. Muammar Gaddafi escaped unharmed, but said his adopted daughter was killed. Some Americans said the raid was cruel. Others praised it. President Reagan said the United States did what it had to do. The president also wanted to intervene in Nicaragua. About 15,000 rebel troops, called Contras, were fighting the country's communist government. President Reagan asked for military aid for the Contras. Congress rejected the request. In fact, it banned all aid to the Contras. At that same time, Muslim extremists in Lebanon seized several Americans. The Reagan administration looked for ways to gain the release of the hostages. It decided to sell missiles and missile parts to Iran in exchange for Iran's help. After the sale, Iran told the extremists in Lebanon to release a few American hostages. Not long after, serious charges became public. Reports said that money from the sale of arms to Iran was used to aid the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. Several members of the Reagan administration resigned. It appeared that some had violated the law. President Reagan said he regretted what had happened, but he said he had not known about it. Investigations and court trials of those involved continued into the 1990s. Several people were found guilty of illegal activities or of lying to Congress. No one went to jail. Most Americans did not blame the president for the actions of others in his administration. They still supported him and his policies. They especially supported his efforts to deal with the Soviet Union. At the beginning of his first term, President Reagan called the Soviet Union an evil empire. To protect the United States against the Soviets, he increased military spending to the highest level in American history. Then, in 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev became the leader of the Soviet Union. Reagan and Gorbachev held four summit meetings in Geneva, Switzerland, Reykjavik, Iceland, Washington, and Moscow. Each leader agreed to destroy hundreds of nuclear missiles. President Reagan also urged General Secretary Gorbachev to become more democratic. He spoke about the Berlin Wall, which communists had built to prevent citizens from crossing between East and West Berlin.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
About this time, a new sense of glasnost, or openness, was beginning in the Soviet Union. It was also a time of perestroika, or restructuring. The American economy grew rapidly during Ronald Reagan's presidency, but at the end of his second term, many Americans were concerned by what he left behind. Increased military spending, together with tax cuts, had made the national debt huge. The United States owed thousands of millions of dollars. The debt would be a political issue for presidents to come. Yet Ronald Reagan will be remembered as one of America's most popular presidents. Above his burial place at the Reagan Library in California are these words which speak to Reagan's belief in humanity. I know in my heart that man is good, that what is right will always eventually triumph, and there is purpose and worth to each and every life.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.